Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States. Episode 4.68, Season 4, A Retrospective. Over the past 67 episodes, we have spent our time looking at how the British North American colonies became so fed up over imperial actions that they decided to break with the mother country, and then ultimately defeat that country in a war. This week I want to move back through the events that have played out over the last 20 years and attempt to fit events into a context. Now, as I mentioned last time, this episode is taking the place of my standard season in review episode. So rather than it being solely focused on trying to summarize some 35 or so hours of material in a half hour today, I thought that it would make more sense to look back over that material and try to figure out exactly what it all had meant. Today in the United States, the Revolution is often portrayed as an against-all-odds victory, overcoming the tyranny of the British monarchy. It is the story of a ragtag group of soldiers who matched up against the most powerful military machine on Earth, and then promptly beat them down, mostly on conviction for their cause and sheer gumption. In place of that tyrannical system that they had just overthrown, they introduced a system based on freedom through democracy. In reality, the American War of Independence was not really any of those things. For example, we talked about how anger towards the king does not really appear until the later stages of the imperial crisis. Those complaints were likewise not necessarily focused squarely on the tyrannical tendencies of George III, but rather criticized him for his failures to protect the colonies from an overreaching parliament. The vast majority of the imperial crisis was focused on the machinations of parliament. Really, though, if we are asking the question of just exactly how the British found themselves losing control over much of their North American empire, much of it seems to come down to a mixture of failing to fully understand the problems that they were facing when it came to their colonies in North America, followed by a poor execution in a war where the British were fighting with little in the way of direction. Beginning during the imperial crisis, as far back as the Stamp Act in 1765, there was clear evidence that the British had failed to grasp the problem that was in front of them. From the earliest moments of the crisis and all the way through until the end of the war, there was always a sense that the British failed to understand the scope of the problems that they were facing. There was a consistent, often bordering on delusional, belief that the events in North America were limited in scope. This constant belief that the events were being driven by a handful of rabble-rousers, while the overwhelming majority of the population remained loyal to their king. Even as British control in the colonies collapsed throughout 1774, we find men like Lord Dartmouth mentioning that everything in the colonies was being run by a small group and that a professional British force should easily be able to quell the unrest. When on the eve of Lexington and Concord, Gage attempted to warn Parliament of the situation by requesting an additional 20,000 troops, all it accomplished was convincing the ministry that Gage was being hysterical and that he needed to be replaced. Let's not neglect the fact that Thomas Gage had been the military commander in North America since the recall of Geoffrey Amherst in 1763. If there was any one person who could establish just how dire the situation was, it was Thomas Gage. And yet, the British chose to ignore him. In fact, even after the war had been going on for a couple of years, the British still believed that the resistance was limited. The entire Southern strategy was predicated on the Southern colonies being the soft underbelly of the American colonies. The British, at least back in London, believed that should they begin a campaign in the South, droves of loyal subjects would be racing out to join the fight. We, of course, know that this is never really going to happen. Sure, there were examples of loyalist units. However, for the most part, even those who may have harbored sympathies for the British seemed less than eager to join the fight. Recall in the days after the British victory at Guilford Courthouse, when Cornwallis came upon that village of seemingly friendly Scottish Highlanders. Although the Highlanders were absolutely in the British camp, they themselves had been stretched so thin by the war that they had nothing to give the beleaguered British troops. In fact, following the British defeat at Cowpens and the subsequent cat-and-mouse chases, everybody raced towards Virginia. Any remaining hope of large numbers of loyalists coming and joining the fight more or less evaporated. Although, really, there is a debate over whether or not that support ever even existed at all. As the British moved to the south, the royal governors would write back to London reassuring them of the undying loyalty to their king. However, despite these optimistic words, words which the ministry back in London ate up to their own disadvantage, the military leadership never fully bought into this narrative. We know, for instance, that Henry Clinton had no doubt about the amount of support he was going to get. After all, he had made an ill-fated attempt on Charleston back in 1776, and those droves of loyal British subjects somehow all seemed to miss the invitation to the party. In fact, in every single instance in the South where you would expect loyalist support, time and time again, few people, if any, showed up. Over and over, the British banked on loyalist support, and despite that support never showing up, they remained almost delusionally optimistic that this, right now, was the time that it would happen. At the same time, the British were being promised that, in addition to those armies of loyalists, local tribes would also relish at the opportunity to join in the fight. Although it is probably true that tribes like the Cherokee would have rejoiced at the chance to slap around those pesky Americans, they were also cognizant that doing so may well lead to their complete annihilation. Sure, it would have been cathartic for the tribes. However, the risk was simply too much. At every single point in the entire conflict, the British consistently underestimated the problem on their hands. The belief in London always seemed to reflect a situation where the events in America were isolated, being driven by that small cadre of radical actors. This belief persisted all the way until the end of the war. The only men who seemed to be cognizant of this failure in intelligence was the military leadership on the ground, who, despite knowing the truth, continued forward in the execution of plans that were predicated on this faulty information. Somewhat amazingly, and likely a clue to the entire situation, when we return next season and begin taking a closer look at the peace negotiations, we will find a British ministry that still, even after deciding shortly before to cease the prosecution of the war against their likely former colonies, believed that reconciliation somehow was still on the table. Now, in their defense, the entire idea was going to be predicated on the French hopefully selling out their allies. Yet, the fact alone that this idea of reconciliation under a common monarch still existed in 1782 after the loss of the Southern Army shows just how much British leadership had their heads buried in the sand. More than just a failure of intelligence when it came to predicting loyalist participation in the war, there was a failure on the part of the British to ever fully figure out exactly what the plan was. Nominally, this seems like an easy question. The colonies were in rebellion. The plan was to end the rebellion and establish order. While this broad outline could generally be agreed upon, what could not be agreed upon was what the exact plan was to accomplish that end. This subject seems somewhat ironic, as it really is not something that we talked that much about during the narrative itself. We did talk at length about the Americans having to decide what their plans were. From the very beginning of the imperial crisis, there was a decent amount of uncertainty in what the overall objectives for the colonists actually were. Now, despite the cries for no taxation without representation, from the very beginning of the crisis, it was abundantly clear to everybody that the colonists were not asking for representation. Men like James Otis, the man who coined that catchphrase to begin with, understood that communications across the Atlantic rendered representation impractical, if not outright impossible. At least early in the imperial crisis, the prevailing desire was for the British to just leave the poor Americans alone. These hopes were all but dashed following the repeal of the Stamp Act and the introduction of the Declaratory Act. Now, the Declaratory Act, in and of itself, did absolutely nothing. It was not a tax. It did not attempt to restrict expansion like the earlier proclamation line. All it did was firmly establish the concept of parliamentary supremacy in the colonies. It clearly laid out that Parliament could pass any tax that they wanted to upon the colonies, and that there was absolutely nothing at all that they could do about it. It made crystal clear to everybody who exactly was running the show. Throughout all of the trials and tribulations of the next several years, Parliament never did back down from the Declaratory Act. Nor really could they. Should Parliament back down from the Act, they would be ceding their authority to govern the colonies, something that would have had a profound effect on the entire British Empire. It is worth noting that, although effectively dead in the United States beginning as early as 1775, the Act did remain in force for the remainder of the empire, at least what was left of it, until the 1960s. As the imperial crisis progressed, more and more we saw the Americans' desire shifting towards the creation of an American parliament, with a shared monarch in George III. This position remained popular well into 1776 among many Americans, including many who we now consider to be loyalists. Joseph Galloway, for instance, remained a loyalist. However, as late as 1774, he was continuing to advocate for the creation of an American Congress, modeled roughly on the Albany Plan of Union. This desire for a separate American Congress, but a shared monarch, was not unique to Galloway either, and indeed it had become a popular position for many of the more conservative members who sought reconciliation. It was not until early 1776 that the independence faction was finally able to gain enough traction to start making meaningful strides. Throughout the first half of 1776, two factions in the United States battled it out for supremacy. Those seeking independence and those seeking reconciliation. Although the necessity of unity in voting made the battle look much closer. In reality, by the late spring, it was increasingly looking like the radicals arguing in favor of a total separation would in fact be carrying the day. What this means is that following July 4th, 1776, when the states had voted for their independence, they had a clear objective in the war. Their goal was to secure their independence from Great Britain. When in 1778 the Carlisle Commission came over and offered essentially what the Americans had been demanding back in 1774, a separate American parliament under a joint monarchy, Congress turned them down and sent them packing. It was too late. Too much blood had been spilled for the Americans to give in. Although it is worth mentioning that amongst the congressmen, there was considerable concern that wide swaths of the population may be less opposed to such measures than is ideal. Either way, however, the Carlisle Commission was all but dead on arrival. The British, despite understanding that their endgame of the war was stopping the rebellion, they never had a clear idea of exactly what that meant. The British had two options available to them when it came to the prosecution of the war. One option is that they absolutely smash the American rebellion. An overwhelming show of power and force that takes the taste of independence out of the mouths of the colonists and firmly establishes just who is running the show. This option did come with some clear drawbacks. there were sympathies in Britain when it came to the Americans. Sure, they were backwards, lacking the civilized refinement of a Londoner, but they were still more or less Englishmen. They were not some conquered people. Likewise, such a harsh response would likely erode any remaining loyalist sentiments that existed inside of the colonies, and push the entire population firmly into the hands of the rebels. The other option was a much softer approach. Yes, you had to put down the rebellion, but then through a mixture of firmness and compassion, you reconcile with the colonies. The British would, of course, throw the colonists a handful of bones here and there. Maybe they would agree to a peace along the lines of what the Carlisle Commission was offering. But at the end of the day, you bring the colonies back into the fold. As you purge out the radicals, you replace them with loyalists. The problem with this plan is that the British would be forced to make concessions. An always dangerous prospect when all over the empire, people were eagerly watching to see just how things would play out. Likewise, the decision not to smash the rebellion might leave open the possibility that down the road the Americans could just try again. A light and kind peace may not fully dissuade such dangerous thinking. The problem is that with two, albeit flawed, options on the table, the British didn't really choose either. Instead, they more just dithered around without any real sense of what their overall plan was. This failure to have a defined plan meant that there was a real lack of clear objectives for the military leadership in North America. Howe, Clinton, Burgoyne, and Cornwallis were forced to fight a war without any specific direction. Problems like a failure to adequately understand an enemy's resolve or a lack of clear objectives are indeed major issues. However, we should also not fail to consider good old-fashioned incompetence as a major contributing factor of the British defeat. One of the truths about this war is that all throughout it, there was never really a lack of what can only be described as systemic incompetence at every level. Let's go back to the implementation of the Stamp Act. Here, we see the British enacting a law with little more than indifference at what the American reaction was going to be. Grenville was warned prior to passing the act that it would not find a warm reception in America. He was in fact warned that such acts would absolutely lead to the American colonists challenging parliamentary authority to pass such a law in the first place. Despite these warnings, where he was told in straight terms what was going to happen, Grenville downplayed the situation. He fully believed that the colonists would spend some time whining over the new acts. They would angrily shake their fists, write some tersely worded letters, and a pamphlet or two, and then move on and pay the duty. The Stamp Act would, in due course, trap the British into a corner where they had few avenues to escape. Grenville loathed the idea of having to back down. However, the Americans had seen to it that the text was never going to be enforceable. Nobody in the colonies was stupid enough to meaningfully attempt collection. Plus, there were merchants back in London who were getting mighty nervous as the American imports began to slow down. The merchants ultimately forced the hand of the government in backing down on the act. Grenville, despite the fact that he had been warned, now found himself arguing that backing down would set a precedent that would ultimately lead to a civil war, which, of course, he was correct on that account. When we look at the imperial crisis following the Stamp Act, we quickly see that it was never really about the revenue anymore. Immediately following the revocation of the Stamp Act, the British would pass the aforementioned Declaratory Act. Things might have calmed down at that point if the Declaratory Act had been a mere effort in saving face. But instead, the British doubled down and were intent on proving that they were the ones calling the shots. So many of the attempts to reform colonial administration were of questionable value, The Townsend Acts, for instance, were never great at increasing the amount of revenue that was being paid back to England. Everybody, the British included, hated them. However, now it was more about proving that they could enforce such an act than anything else. Of course, not all of the acts that passed had anything to do with revenue collection. However, by this time the colonists saw Parliament as being bad actors across the board. If their argument was that taxes could not be passed against them in a body where they lacked representation, then really, how could that body have any control over them at all? It is interesting to note that by the time of the Revolution, the colonists in their redresses just started ignoring the existence of Parliament altogether. The Declaration of Independence never once mentions Parliament in an attempt to show that the colonists did not recognize their authority. The imperial crisis showed a lack of creativity on the part of the British government. They never meaningfully did anything to attempt to mend the relationship between them and their colonies. Rather, they mostly just kept trying the exact same tactics over and over again, hoping to exhaust the colonies into submission. Admittedly, sometimes it did work. There were at least two distinct periods where the colonists did appear to be exhausted, and low-level apathy allowed the British just a little bit more flexibility. However, these were always temporary interludes, more than a meaningful change in attitude. By the time that we reached the Tea Act and the subsequent destruction of the tea in Boston Harbor, what had taken over was essentially a staring contest between the two sides. As much as the Americans were entrenching, so were the British, who hit the colonists with the Punitive Intolerable Acts in 1774. From that point on, events were largely past the point of no return, as war became increasingly inevitable. When looking at events in retrospect, there was an overwhelming lack of creativity when it came to pulling everybody back from the precipice and avoiding the war. The British, who were always going to need to be the ones to make those critical steps to avoid a war, were far more interested in trying to legislate the colonies back into compliance. By the time we reached 1775, options were, to be fair, likely dwindling. However, I still suspect that had the British offered something akin to what the Carlisle Commission did in 1778, that may well have avoided the outbreak of violence. If British diplomacy with the colonies prior to Lexington and Concord leaves something to be desired, the military decisions being made during the war itself were downright derelict. Questionable military decisions from start to finish hampered the war, and would help play a decisive role in explaining why the British would ultimately lose the war. This theme is really set from the very beginning. The first battle of the war involved Thomas Gage marching out to Concord to recover some stolen cannons. Gage was well aware that the cannons had already been moved out of Concord prior to his march. He knew that this entire thing was just a fool's errand. Yet, he decided that doing something was better than doing nothing, and pushed forward anyway. Well, he certainly did not intend to kick off a war that night. That was exactly what happened. By the next morning, the British were essentially trapped inside of Boston. A few months later, following the arrival of Clinton, Burgoyne, and Howe, the British would slam themselves, repeatedly, into the American positions during the Battle of Bunker Hill, securing a hard-earned and largely Pyrrhic victory. Both Bunker Hill and Lexington and Concord can be explained. In Lexington and Concord, the goal had not been to start a war. It was a recovery mission that went sideways. Likewise, the British felt that controlling Charlestown was critical in securing Boston. What is harder to explain, however, were the actions of Howe the following year, when he failed to press his advantage after defeating the Americans during the Battle of Long Island. Howe was overly cautious immediately following the victory, This, as well as one of many well-timed storms during the war, gave Washington the opportunity to withdraw and save his army. Had an aggressive commander pushed the issue and continued the assault following the victory at Long Island, there is a good chance that the Americans would have lost a 12,000-man army to the British. This lack of aggression might have been forgivable. Howe had seen the previous year's battle at Bunker Hill and the price for storming a fortified location. Plus, he had planned on working with his brother to essentially lay siege to the American position. If not for that storm slowing up the Royal Navy, maybe this would have worked out. But of course, we will never know. Possibly the biggest errors in judgment from everybody came the following year. On the one hand, you had John Burgoyne leading his army south in an attempt to gain control over the Hudson and cut off New England. During this march, he did a fantastic job of making these grand proclamations that he was going to enlist the Indians to his cause, something that caused a huge amount of fear and anger in everybody who lived along the American frontiers. In the battle for the hearts and the minds of the average citizen in North America, the American press had a field day off of moments like this. For those Americans who remained apathetically sitting on the fence, Burgoyne's proclamation was a nice shove for them towards the patriot cause. Boasting aside, everything about this particular campaign was flawed. Ignoring all of the problems that Burgoyne had with his supply chain, possibly the biggest issue that he had was Howe. We talked about this at length, but the decision of Howe to pretty much ignore Burgoyne and focus on Philadelphia was baffling. There is little debate today that the correct decision for Howe should have been to go and help Burgoyne cut off New England. Instead, Howe took Philadelphia, a city which he held for a few months before heading back to the north and concentrating his forces in New York. For his trouble, Burgoyne saw the entire Northern Army defeated and subsequently captured by the Americans, a loss that was significant enough that the French decided that it was a good time to get involved in the war. Years later, we would see just as big of a collapse in command at Yorktown. This time it was Henry Clinton ordering Cornwallis into an impossible-to-defend position, where the Allied forces were able to trap him in. Cornwallis, who was actively aware of the trap that he was falling into, then just sat idly by waiting for a rescue that was never going to come as the Americans and the French tightened the noose around his neck. As with Burgoyne years before, this would lead to the entire loss of the Southern Army and ultimately the end of major hostilities in the North American theater. Yorktown and Saratoga stand as the two biggest disasters for the British of the entire war. They are losses that, aside from the human toll, had massive impacts on how the war was prosecuted. These two losses are really just the most egregious as well. We already mentioned questionable decisions at Bunker Hill and in New York, but all throughout the war, the British military leadership, time and time again, missed valuable opportunities to change the tide of things. As we back up and look at the war as a whole, in an attempt to determine how exactly everybody got to this point, I think we can walk away with a few main takeaways. From the imperial crisis all the way through the end of the war, the British vastly underestimated the problem on their hands. They failed to ever fully grasp just how much support they had lost in their colonies. Believing that the imperial crisis and later the war remained a limited affair, being conducted by a small number of radicals. Once in the war, their military failed to ever settle upon a cohesive goal, and then followed that up with a deeply flawed field command that, on multiple occasions, left the British badly exposed. This is, of course, just scratching the surface of what happened in North America. We indeed just spent 67 episodes going through the entire war, and the many many mistakes and errors by the British. However, I feel as though it is these overarching themes that really begin to explain how the British found themselves, having to do the previously unthinkable, and to begin the process of peace negotiations with the United States. Likewise, none of this is meant to take away from the accomplishments of the Americans and their commanders. George Washington had proven himself to be a capable general, despite the fact that prior to the Revolution, he had a relatively paltry resume. Although Washington lacked the training and education of his adversaries, he understood the war, and importantly, he understood the objectives. Once Washington came to accept the idea of a war of posts, and accepted the idea that winning the war meant keeping an army in the field, he thrived. Although it sounds like something of a backhanded compliment, Washington's ability to withdraw his army under the most stressful situations saved the Americans on more than one occasion. Even when disaster was looming, Washington remained ever calm and firmly in command. Never do we see him lose his composure and turn and run from a battle. This is something that we know the danger of because we saw it firsthand, following the devastating results of when Horatio Gates took off, following the loss at Camden. The Continentals would prove to have their fair share of capable commanders. In addition to Washington, you had Greene, Knox, Morgan, occasionally Horatio Gates, and yes, Benedict Arnold prior to his treachery. This is to say nothing of the brilliant job done by so many others in the backcountry of the Carolinas as they clawed back control over the region throughout 1781. At the end of the day, Washington and company understood that the primary objective was not to win battles, but rather to ensure that if there was a battle, that the British paid for it. This was most clearly seen at Bunker Hill and Guilford Courthouse, both battles which the Americans lost. However, in the process they extracted such a high price that they were, in reality, the de facto winners. Even with this understanding that victory would be best achieved by not being forced from the field, the Americans would still take advantage if they could. In both Saratoga and Yorktown, the Americans saw British weakness, and they seized on the moment to great success. Once the French entered into the war, it just meant that the British were now stretched that much more thinly. They were a country without significant allies fighting what they believed to be a civil war. The entrance of the French into the war meant that the British had to adapt to a war that suddenly threatened the rest of their empire and quickly expanded beyond being merely an internal issue. This is to say nothing for the critical importance of the French Navy, who very much helped make the American victory at Yorktown possible. Finally, although it is fun to sit around and talk up the narrative of that ragtag army of farmers defeating the most powerful army in the world, it is ultimately a fiction. The primary power of the British military was their navy, which, although dominating the waters off the North American coast for much of the war, was often a non-entity during the war. Although I think it is probably safe to say that the British redcoats were better trained and equipped as compared to the Continentals, they were also having to fight a war far from home. For the British, their losses were always magnified because of the practical considerations of how much more difficult it was to replace those losses. Moreover, as we saw during the later stages of the war in the South, that extended distance from home made maintaining supply lines that much more of a headache. Again, this is not to diminish the accomplishments of the Americans, but rather is to illustrate that this was never a totally even fight. The United States had advantages in the war and, for the most part, did a very good job of exploiting those advantages. As we wrap up for today, and ultimately for this season, we come to the natural question of trying to understand exactly what all of this had meant. Although it is potentially a disappointing answer, the effects of the American War of Independence were not exactly clear at the end of 1781. Yes, the colonies were likely going to enjoy some level of independence. However, exactly what that meant was still unclear. Would the British push for a treaty in line with what was being proposed years before by the Carlisle Commission? A situation where they attempted to salvage the monarchy's supremacy, while acquiescing to giving the Americans an independent parliament? Would the powers agree to the concept of uni possidetis, giving the British wide swaths of the American South as well as New York and parts of the Northeast? As we conclude our story on the war, we have yet to, actually, you know, conclude the war. Those questions lie in the future for us. More importantly than just the peace settlement that will be reached is the question of exactly how the United States is going to fit into the greater balance of power. As the United States entered into the world as an independent actor, they were going to be forced to consider that role and how they would coexist in a world filled with allies and enemies alike, where everybody was after their own self-interest. Even among their allies, the United States found themselves operating in a precarious position, as everybody sought to further their own cause with little regard for the Americans or their position at the table. This tension is apparent even amongst American allies. The Netherlands, as we are going to see next time, would be a late addition to the war, providing the United States with both recognition and a much-needed loan, though they are not going to have a seat at the negotiating table at the end of the war. The Spanish existed as less of an immediate ally, and more of an example of that old adage that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Despite fighting in the war for the last several years, the Spanish had zero interest in recognizing the United States, and would not do so until 1783. Had you asked the Spanish at the time, they would have happily touted their relationship with France, while pretending not to notice the United States standing over there in the corner. Finally, you have the most important American ally of all, the French. France was never involved in this war because they loved the ideals being espoused in the American Revolution. If you don't believe me, and think that Louis XVI has any love for the concepts of republicanism and democracy, I recommend that you check out the next two decades of French history. It will really show just how much Louis XVI loved democracy. The French fought with the Americans because they wanted to avenge their losses from the Seven Years' War and poke Great Britain in the eye with a sharp stick. Think back to that party that Washington threw following the victory in Yorktown. Recall that the British and the French got along great, like old friends, who had just gone through this song and dance hundreds of times before. The Americans were the outsiders. The British and the French officers, they had an intrinsic connection to each other via their upper-class status. The Americans had no meaningful concept of an aristocracy or nobility. Sure, the French had just fought and helped secure their independence, but make no mistake, they were still viewed as being nothing more than backwater provincials. With the war now shifting from a focus on fighting to one more centered upon the negotiating table, the United States was going to have to deal with the fact that everybody was acting out of their own self-interest. If the Americans were going to demand a seat at the table, they were going to be forced into a game with vastly more skilled opponents. We are going to leave it here for today. There is always more to say on the subject, but I feel like we have done the revolution justice, and that it is time to put it behind us. Next time, we will begin the fifth season of this podcast as we move into the early republic. The war was coming to an end, leaving the soon-to-be former British colonies asking the all-important question, now what? Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 3 weeks. Now, I say 3 weeks because, yes, we are indeed going to be delaying the next episode by 1 week. Now, I've actually needed to do this for a while to get everything back lined up the way I like it, and, well, this just seems like a pretty good time to do it. So, this is not some permanent change. We're not going to longer release cycles. I just need an extra week this time around. So, with that all being said, I hope that you are all staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as we usher in the Early Republic.